Record, make sure it's going. Yeah, there we go.
I've actually forgotten to record the last two. So I thought I'd give a talk on the tyranny of mood and how to work with it. Tonight I'm going to be focusing on mostly anxiety. But the tyranny of mood could be really used for anything. It could be for outrage and anger. It could be used for self-pity. It could be used for, shame, guilt. Any sudden overpowering mood that arises. In general, to give an overview of the way moods and anxiety works, the first thing to bear in mind is that most of the triggers, the external events in the world that trigger a mood, we tend to misperceive the true nature of how triggers work to give birth to reactions in us. For instance, suppose we get dumped from a relationship or suddenly fired from a job or someone out of the blue insults us or disses us, somebody who we thought was a friend stops returning messages. All these events can be very startling and can feel extremely hurtful. And obviously, to a certain degree, the emotions that arise are partially attributable to these events, but the more one studies the way the human mind works, a lot of the emotional underpinning that gives weight to our reactions is because emotions work associatively. They trigger older buried feelings that reside unconsciously and attach themselves to anything that is similar to the original experience that caused discomfort. I'll be specific, if that's a little abstract. For example, in childhood, we all experience rejection or feelings of abandonment by our caretakers. We all feel scared when we're left alone. We feel when we're socialized in schools. We feel very often like we don't fit in. We feel like there's something different often about ourselves. And so these can form the foundational traumatic experiences. And these wounds that occur from the early feelings of rejection and abandonment can deeply reside and not truly be fully healed. And so later on in life, when we experience any kind of rejection at all, for instance, a relationship or getting fired from a job or getting dissed by someone, it can trigger the older feelings that have been buried, that we thought, you know, perhaps even weren't there, but remain unconsciously very potent. This is why we can often be in relationships that are very brief, and when they fall apart, can still be as painful as a long-term relationship falling apart, because they've attached themselves to older feelings. This is the associative nature of the amygdala. It's the way the fear and anxious mind associates and gives emotional valence to things by constantly attaching new experiences to older ones. So, we have a tendency then to go off into a spiral of thoughts, thinking if we could only figure out what we did wrong in this latest event, or what we should have said, or how we can undo it, or how we could get our job back or get back in the relationship, we wouldn't have to feel this shitty. And of course, the misunderstanding is that a lot of the suffering is coming about because of older feelings that have been unleashed. Now, the mind goes into what psychiatrists like to call cognitive dissonance, which means thoughts that cause suffering. For example, when we lose a job or we're hit with a bill we can't pay or a relationship becomes rocky, we often fall into catastrophizing thoughts, which is going to the worst possible outcome. An example of that is you perhaps get a new job and the first day sucks. You're like, what the fuck did I fucking do? I got this job. This is terrible. People are mean. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. They can tell I'm a fraud. This is ridiculous. And then the mind goes into a catastrophizing thought, which is, oh shit, this is what the rest of life will be like. I'll be trapped in this job, and it will suck. And I've blown it. So that's catastrophizing. There's also, of course, jumping to conclusions. You get like a funny scan from a doctor and immediately we have cancer, whatever. There's also, preventative what-ifs. The mind doesn't like being caught off guard. And so very often it will spiral into a series of trying to figure out where the next piece of bad news will come from. Because it feels like it was caught off guard, it wasn't vigilant enough, so it becomes hypervigilant. Which brings me up also to hypervigilance, which is the trait of trying to read other people's expressions. And then on top of it, we have trying to rewrite the past, which is, for instance, after a breakup, going back and thinking of all the things we should have said or should have done, or the times we get fired and after we've walked out the door, think of all the cutting remarks we should have said to the person who fired us exactly 10 minutes too late. So all these things have one thing in common. They achieve absolutely nothing. And they cause stress. I've never in my entire life, by the way, figured out a solution to life's setbacks through worry. Never once. In my experience, all of the solutions I've ever come up with, like this is a brilliant one I had when I would get fired, I would look for another job. None of that comes about through worrying. Worrying is, oh shit, I won't be able to pay the bills. I really blew it this time. I'm a fraud. Or, this is great. Now I can record that double album I've always wanted to record. And fuck these making money ideas. So then, there's enough suffering with what the Buddha called kariya, the repetitive anxious mind state. But then on top of it, the Buddha also points out that we have a very substratum of undermining stressors that we're not even largely aware of that make the anxiousness even more uncomfortable. We not only have all these thoughts about trying to undo the past, trying to figure out what the next terrible thing that'll happen to us is, speculation, overgeneralization, catastrophizing. But underneath, the breath becomes more and more shallow and uncomfortable. The body starts holding defensive feelings or postures. We become tight in the stomach. The shoulders become habitually hard and uplifted towards the ears. The forehead becomes locked and the jaw becomes tight, and there's this just this sense of, okay, fuck you world, you know, fuck this, or the sense of just being overwhelmed by life and being defensive and guarded. Then on top of it, we also have a very jumpy mind. It's very difficult for the mind to land when it's got all these thoughts, all these sensations, the breath is so uncomfortable and shallow, it's very difficult for the mind to settle and maintain any peacefulness. So, now, if that was enough, it would be a pretty unpleasant experience, but that's not even where the suffering stops. The Buddha said, on top of all that, that's the very, that's like the early stages of suffering. We then go on in the chain of suffering to develop two additional responses. The Buddha said, we either seek escape from the anxiousness, the fear, the sadness, the anger. We seek something to make us make it all go away. This is a movement that indicates drugs. Why that indicates drugs, I have no idea. But drugs, alcohol, TV, shopping, putting that credit card to use, numbing our feelings with food, anything we do to shut down, to numb out. And of course, this just creates even more suffering because we add on top of the whirlwind of thoughts and uncomfortable body states, we now add addiction. Or B, if that's not the route we choose, then the other route we choose is self-centered ideation, which means we get lost in a whirlpool of why me, what's wrong with me, look at my mind, I can't shut down my mind, I'm losing my mind, oh my God, I'm totally fucked, I'll never be normal again, I can't believe this is happening to me, there's something deeply wrong. So we either run from the feelings, or we are so overwhelmed by the anxiousness and the sadness and the gloom and the anger that we're now self-cognizant of just how much of our experience is being overwhelmed by that state, and we add on top of it a meta-story about ourselves and how we'll never achieve any peace in life again. So this is quite a mixture of discomfort, to say the least. What we wind up doing as a result of all this cognition and stress and this spiraling of cognitive dissonance that's completely out of control, the thoughts that are dark and trying to figure out things that can't be figured out, the trying to undo things that can't be undone, the uncomfortable body, what we wind up doing is becoming disembodied, which means unaware of the body. We wind up completely living in our heads. And then, as the suffering and the stories and the self-pity become even worse, then we become what's known as dissociative, which means we don't only drop awareness of the body, we drop awareness of things that are happening all around us. People will say things to us, we won't hear them. We'll even lose track of where we are. We will be defensive, even though we're with people who are kind and compassionate. We'll become remote, even though there's something beautiful to look at around us. We won't be aware of anything that's happening. So disembodied, a lack of awareness of the body, and dissociation, which is a lack of awareness of not only the body, but what's happening, where we are, a distortion of the situation, the events, the experience, becomes the hallmark of a mood that has become overwhelming. So, luckily there are tools that can come to our aid. Most of the time when we try to work with anxiousness, anxiety, fear, these emotional states, we get flummoxed by the fact that they don't respond to our reasoning. We try to tell ourselves, well, can't I think about something else? Why do I think about this fear? This is stupid. I should know better. I shouldn't be this wound up. I shouldn't be distraught by this relationship ending. I should... why do I feel so beaten down? The Buddha taught that before we go into any kind of condescending self-rationalization, which tends to be co-opted very quickly by the mood itself, the practice is to first do what we generally never do with moods, which is instead of running away from them or B, indulging them by allowing the thoughts, the repetitive cognitions, the ideations, all the storytelling of how bad life will turn out, how we'll never be in another good relationship, how we'll never find another good job, how we'll never get a good apartment, how whatever, instead of following the or allowing the stories in our minds to dominate us or be running away from them, we choose a third approach, which is to make an appointment with fear, make an appointment with anxiety, make an appointment with sadness, rather than waiting for it to come and kick us in the ass. We sit, we get comfortable, and we first say, okay, what needs to be felt now? And we open. How does, we can even ask this question. If we've been through, say, I don't know, any hypothetical? Give me a hypothetical. No
hypothetical. Lost your job.
Lost your job. So you've just lost your job, and we're feeling overwhelmed, and we've looked at Craigslist, and every job sounds shitty, and we've decided that we can't live in New York, and we're going to have to crawl home with our tail between our legs to our parents, and oh my God, we're over 40 years old, and this is the end. So that's the tyranny of mood. So what we do is we sit, we get comfortable, find a good posture, and we, after we close our eyes, we simply say, okay, how does it feel to have lost my job? And we just leave it at that. We don't go into the story. That son of a bitch, I was the one who's doing all the work. Those fuckers didn't do any work. Why me? Fuck them. I'm going to, if only I had told them, like, how little work blah, blah, blah does. Fuck this. No. We simply ask the question, how does it feel? And then we sit, and we open to the energy, the feeling of first outrage, which is generally the way we first greet sudden shocks. Then the next thing we open to is the feeling of confusion. What do I do now? And the feelings of fear. And all of these feelings are overlays we have to go through, because deep down beneath these feelings are deeper feelings. They're the feelings we have from childhood of not being truly taken care of by our caretakers. The feelings that we have from when we were kids being introduced to school and not being good enough. And those feelings of confusion when we entered the world as young adults. How will I survive in this place? And this, the feelings of when we graduated from school and having no idea what we were going to do next. All of these feelings of, holy shit, this is too much, are down there. These feelings of being overwhelmed, and we open to them. And we feel them. And we don't resist them. We give them space to arise. And when we give the feelings beneath each mood, the embodied feelings beneath each mood, a space to arise, what we find is that so long as we keep at least some of our awareness on the body and on the breath and on the sounds, the mind is big enough that it can contain anything, any bad news, any bad experience, any suffering, we can hold it. There's an old Buddhist saying, actually attributed to the Buddha. The Buddha said that if you pour a tablespoon of salt into a glass of water, the water becomes undrinkable. But if you pour the same spoonful of salt into a lake, the lake water is still very drinkable. The metaphor means that if the mind is wide and spacious and big enough, if it doesn't get swallowed up by the stories of our thinking, our projections of the future, the mind is wide enough and spacious enough that it can contain even the most painful feelings that we thought we could never sit with. So the practice is to get really peaceful, maintain the breath, the body. These are the things that give width to the mind, the sounds. All of these things create a sense of spaciousness in the mind, and then allow the feelings to arise in the body. To feel what anxiousness feels like, to feel what sadness feels like, to feel what the breath of sadness is. So long as we keep the mind bigger by grounding it in the present, we can contain anything. Now, the next step is to open to what the thoughts of these moods are. But before we listen to the thoughts and work with them, we first look at them from a little bit of a distance. Like, we say, hello, anxiousness. But we still haven't gone up to speak with anxiousness. Anxiousness is a domineering person in the party of our mind. With all those other voices, we've got compassion, we've got self-esteem, and we've got pride, and we've got all those other thoughts, and then suddenly this dominating character has entered the mind, fear. And fear is there, I won't be able to pay my bills, I just lost my job. I won't be able to pay my bills, fuck you, shut up everybody. And the compassion voices and the voices of I'll be okay and the voices of maybe I should listen to somebody else. They're all cowering because it's a monster. You won't be able to pay your bills, fucker. You just lost your job. So obviously, this is a pretty powerful guest. So we don't. If you had somebody that like that who walked into a party, it's like you ever see like that movie where it was 300. It's like, would you walk up to these characters? No, you wouldn't. You'd be okay. This is a kind of a scare. Before I go up and listen to anything and take what this person has to say is real, I'm going to just see just how dangerous and how crazy this voice is. So you listen to the voice from afar. You know, okay, is it screaming? Is it threatening? Is it belittling? Is it painting dark futures that it can't possibly know? How is this voice creating so much fear in the mind? How is it creating so much disturbance? So we keep our distance. We're not even listening to what it's saying. We're just noting what its demeanor is. And then, if we conclude that the voice of fear is something that we feel we can work with, we then set aside a time to sit and first just write out everything the mood has to say. Everything, without editing it at all. Just allow it to come out. Allow it to spew. Everything comes out. This is really important because when we argue with or resist the voice of fear or anxiousness, what happens is we don't really see how truly insane it truly can be. The story I tell over and over about the time I didn't
want to ask for a vacation because I thought if I was on vacation, my boss would see how little work I did and would fire me when I got back, and then I wouldn't be able to get another job, so I'd wind up homeless, where I'd be killed on the street by knife-wielding gangs. So asking for a vacation was, in my mind, a life-endangering endeavor. It would lead to my death. So, but if I interfered at any point, I wouldn't see the true ludicrousness of what that fear and how it held me in such terror. So I had to write it out. It was only when I saw it on paper that I realized, oh my God, this is not a monster. This is a 5-year-old version of Josh who really felt that if, you know, he asked for anything, he would be completely shown up and would wind up without any, you know, buddy taking care of him. It was that little 5-year-old coward. And once I saw that, the monster was gone. And I was just there with this 5-year-old voice of being frightened of asking for anything. That's what, you know, writing it all out can do. Now, sometimes when we write things out, there are some truth to it. There's the completely outlandish stuff like that. There's also the stuff that we can't do anything about. The, oh my God, I have cancer, I have cancer, I have cancer. Did I tell you I have cancer? I'm sure I have cancer. That strange thing on my skin has to be terminal cancer. There's no way that we can work with that other than see that it's projecting a dire outcome. But there's a third kind. There's a third kind of speech, which is the ones that are somewhat grounded in reality. This would be the, oh my God, I have these bills and I can't pay them. And that might be true. When we see a real thought like that, then when we sit and we breathe and we get the body comfortable, then we can see what the obvious steps are to deal with that situation. Which is basically I have to call up a creditor and just say, hey, I can't pay this. Can I come up with a payment schedule? That's a way of dealing with the real underlying truths that might be packed in there along with all the bad, you know, unforeseeable, unknown speculations and projections. One thing, though, that's very helpful for me, that's completely transformed the way I relate to all of the moods that arise, and sit with them and not be pushed around and not act out on them and just allow them to be, is the reflection that the stuff I need to be truly peaceful and happy in this life is so much different than what my mind is programmed to think I need. This world tells me that I need money, that I need lots of Facebook friends, that I need a beautiful apartment, or a nice apartment at least, or even an apartment. I need a career that's profound and impressive, that I need approval from people, that I need to have everybody think I'm wonderful. So basically the world sets us off on this chase for external comforters, external security blankets that make us feel like we can't be touched. And the truth is, of course, we can all be touched, and we will all be touched by illness, sickness, old age, death, separation. And none of those things that we are often quest on and get flattened if they get taken away from us, if our art or our careers or if our relationships or anything like that gets pulled out, there's this feeling not only of, oh, this sucks, which is, of course,
a realistic one, but then there's this feeling of, oh my God, I'm just going to fall apart. I'm never going to get anything. This is how one finds security. And what spiritual practice teaches us is, in fact, no. The true stuff of happiness can't be taken away from us. It's not at risk. It's not vulnerable. Nobody can take from me my gratitude. Nobody can take from me the opportunities to be generous and kind with myself and with others. No one can take away from me my ability to appreciate the happiness of others and my own skillfulness. The requisites the Buddha talked of that we need for happiness, clothing, food, and medicine, and shelter, even in my absolute most darkest moments as a drug user in my past, were rarely at risk. I love the Go into the dark and the sun, I guess it's like... Suddenly I was in a British comedy. 1940s. Completely didn't match at all what I was talking about. But anyway. So the truth, to sum it up, is that the more we become... deeper into our spiritual practice, the more time we spend cultivating peace through skillful acts and through meditation, the less vulnerable and the less overtaken by moods I become, because very few things are as threatening to me as they once were. In addition to that, the ability to allow feelings to arise without them pushing me around, without resisting them, without feeling like there's something unique about me, to know that these moods are all universal and that it's my job simply to create space for the energy to arise and pass, to put aside what thoughts cannot be dealt with and deal with what issues can be, to be compassionate with myself. These are the ways we can live with anything the mind throws at us, anything at all. So thank you very much for listening. Hope there was something there worth reflecting on. I'm going to turn off the...